Welcome to On Campus with CITI Program. My name is Ed Butch, and I will be your new host for season two of the podcast. I'm excited to be here with you all. My first guest is Dr. Metin Aaron. Dr. Aaron, a Cleveland St. Ignatius High School graduate, is an associate professor of archaeology at Kent State University and a research associate at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. He did his undergraduate degree at Harvard and his master's and PhD degrees at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. He also has a second master's degree in experimental archaeology from the University of Exeter and a certificate in ceramic art from Canterbury College. He has published over 200 scholarly papers and three edited books. His research, which focuses on Stone Age archaeology and the evolution of technology, has been regularly featured in international media, including PBS Nova, the History Channel, the BBC, the Discovery Channel, NPR, Meat Eater, among others. Today, we are going to discuss Dr. Aaron's role as a mentor to both undergraduate and graduate students. Before we get started, I wanted to quickly note that this podcast is for educational purposes only. It is not designed to provide legal advice or legal guidance. You should consult with your organization's attorneys if you have questions or concerns about the relevant laws and regulations that may be discussed. In addition, the views expressed in this podcast are solely those of our guest. And on that note, welcome to the podcast, Dr. Aaron.
Hey, how's it going?
Not bad, not bad. Thanks for joining and being my very first guest.
Definitely, it's exciting.
Very good, very good. Well, you know, to kind of let everyone out there know, I worked with you a little bit when I was at Kent State as well, especially on student recruitment and things like that. So I was excited to be able to invite you on today. You know, you have a fascinating background, and just can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and really your role at Kent State?
Yeah. So I actually grew up in Northeast Ohio, which is where Kent State is located. And so when a position opened up 8 years ago, it was a dream come true to come back to Northeast Ohio. There's lots of great places in the world, but for me, Northeast Ohio is the greatest place on earth. And so to come back and do archaeology, which is my specialty, I couldn't ask for anything more. But I founded the Kent State Experimental Archaeology Lab. And in that lab, we actually recreate and then reverse engineer ancient technologies to figure out how they work. And then once we know how these things work, we can build models of how technology evolved over the last 3 million years.
Fantastic. And I was lucky enough to be able to tour your lab a couple of times, which was great. And can you just provide a little bit more about what you really do in the experimental archaeology lab?
Yeah. So by recreating all these ancient technologies, we have to sort of have or develop skills that, you know, the average person may not have. So for example, I'm considered to be an expert flint napper, and flint napping is the art and process of making tools out of flakeable stone. So I make knife blades and arrowheads and all sorts of tools, scrapers out of stone, like chert and obsidian and basalt. And once we make these things, we really put them through hell. We use them to butcher animals. We shoot them. We have a ballistics range in our lab where we shoot replicas of ancient arrows. But we've got all of our students and professors in the lab have their own skills. We have ceramic artists. We have people who do metallurgy, like forging. We have woodworkers. It's a unique place and a unique lab. There's not really a lab like it anywhere in the world. So we're just really fortunate to have this resource here at Kent State.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I love that you mentioned, you know, obviously the students in your lab as well. And that's, you know, really why I wanted to have you on our On Campus podcast today is to really talk about your involvement in your mentoring of students. And I know in your time that you've mentored a lot of undergraduate and graduate students at Kent. But what does student mentoring really mean to you as a faculty member?
Yeah, mentoring means everything. Right? Whether it's in the classroom or in the laboratory, the chair of our department, Marianne Raganti, says to the faculty regularly that we are here for the students. And all of the faculty in Kent State Anthropology really take that to heart. I mean, we would not exist if it were not for students. And so it's something that all faculty need to take very seriously. You know, students not only should sort of be taken care of in the classroom, but we need to get students involved in research, in activities like in the field, really anything a professor does, I think we need to involve students at the academic level. It's vitally important. I'd like to say too that experimental archaeology is kind of cool because we can really utilize student skills that, you know, otherwise might not be appreciated in other disciplines. So, you know, it takes years to become a great craftsperson in wood, right? Or to become a ceramic artist or even a musician, right? We can't teach that to undergraduates. They have to have already had those skills. But in our lab, we actually look for people that have those sorts of specialized skills because, you know, we need people who can make spear shafts. We need people who can make pots. We need people who can make, you know, arrowheads. We can teach them the science in a year or two, right? When they're students. But we can't teach them that 10 or 15 years of craftsperson skill. So we kind of try to turn recruiting of students on its head and really illustrate to students that these skills that you may not perceive as being sort of academic or valuable academically actually are. You know, for example, we had a tattoo artist as one of our students, and he had no idea that, you know, people in the past would actually make needles out of stone. Yeah. And so we did some experiments where I would make the stone needles and then he would use them to tattoo things and like really bringing modern skills and showing how they can inform on the past has opened a lot of our students' eyes into how all aspects of knowledge are really interconnected.
Definitely. That's wonderful. And I know in my time, you know, at Kent, I always really appreciated, you know, the anthropology department and what you really did for your and with your students as well. I want to take a little bit of a step back and I guess look at your career as well in terms of, you know, you've kind of been, as our listeners heard in the intro, all over the world. And so how has mentoring really played a role in your career?
Yeah, I've been really lucky because I've done field work and experiments in North America and Asia, Europe, Africa, all over the place. And that's only possible because of the mentoring I got. I actually started archaeology when I was 16 years old at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. And it was Dr. Brian Redmond, who is the curator there, who, you know, when I went to the museum, he kind of looked at this kid skeptically, the 16-year-old high school student. But, you know, he took me under his wing. And before I even got to university, I was directing graduate students at excavations, which I'm sure they loved to have some team.
I'm sure.
Tell them what to do. But so that got me going, right? I mean, and that shows the power of amazing mentoring to take a high school student and take that person under their wing. And so I knew going into college, I was going to be an archaeologist. And then my undergraduate advisor, the late Ofer Bar Yosef at Harvard, gave me an office as an undergraduate in his lab.
Wow.
So that, you know, opened up all sorts of doors and I was able to publish because of Ofer as an undergraduate in top peer-reviewed journals. And then my PhD advisor, David Meltzer at Southern Methodist University, you know, provided all sorts of opportunities for me and taught me all sorts of things. And so what's amazing too, I just want to say is that each of those people, and there's other mentors I haven't had a chance to mention, but they all have their own styles, right? And they provide different skills and different experiences. So I think the most important thing for me was understanding and having a variety and diversity of mentors, right? Because one mentor can't provide everything. It's just impossible. It's also unfair to that mentor to sort of demand that. So the fact that I was very fortunate to have a variety of mentors in a variety of places with strengths and weaknesses, right? Just influenced me and my own style. And you probably, you know, your listeners who are faculty members have that experience too. And then they take bits and pieces from their own mentors and develop their own style. Yeah, it's a circle.
Yeah, definitely. I love that, you know, the variety and kind of looking at those strengths and weaknesses, because though we don't always like to focus on our weaknesses, we all have them, right?
Oh, yeah. No, definitely.
It's good to look at.
Well, I think the thing too is none of my mentors ever claimed to be the end all be all. And all of them always were working on their weaknesses. So we can't be good at everything. But one thing I learned from all of them was that even though we can't be good at everything, doesn't mean we don't try our best, right? And work on our weaknesses, because our weaknesses don't have to be as weak as they would be otherwise. So mentoring is huge, right? And I think any faculty member out there will tell you that, you know, it played a huge influence in their own lives.
For sure. Definitely. Now I know, you know, throughout this and throughout your time at Kent, you've worked with, you know, multiple students who have gone on to some prestigious, you know, graduate programs or received postgraduate awards. Can you just tell us about a student or two and kind of the paths that they took?
Yeah, no, definitely. We've had a huge variety of students, and we've been so lucky to interact with all these great people. So, for example, we had a student from Parma, Ohio, named Anna Micah. And I remember she took my class on the very first Stone Age Americans 13,000 years ago. And the student really was real quiet, didn't say anything. She was an undergraduate. And so I didn't really, you know, when they're quiet, you're like, who is this person? And then, but by the end of the semester, she had outperformed every student by like 10%, right? I mean, she got the highest grade in the class. I was like, oh my goodness, who is this person? And so we, you know, I talked to her, and as I talked to her, I realized just this was a brilliant human, right? And invited her into my own lab and got her working on various projects. And just like me, we got her publishing as an undergraduate in the peer-reviewed literature. And she published in journals like PLOS One, which is a major international journal. And this was all as an undergraduate. She contributed to several other papers that we did in really meaningful and substantive ways. So by the time she finished as an undergraduate, we here at Anthropology thought, well, there's more that she could benefit from. So she became a master's student here at Kent State. And she published even more, right? Her master's thesis was published. I mean, I think she had 10 or 12 papers by the time she finished her master's, right?
That's amazing.
Yeah. And then she applied to the University of Cambridge in England, right? The Cambridge. Yeah. And not only was accepted, but was awarded the Harding Fellowship, which basically covered all of her tuition, all of her research, everything for the entire PhD. And so it's hard to get more successful than that. And she's currently working on her PhD right now at Cambridge. And so that's just one example. You know, I mentioned our tattoo artist. That's a guy named Dusty Norris. I guess one other example, I mean, I could go on and on, because we've had people go all over the world from Kent State to different programs. But we had a student named Heather Smith. And she was a mature student, non-traditional student. And she came in as a master's student. And in a previous life, she was actually a professional violinist for an orchestra.
Wow.
Yeah, amazing, right? But she always had interests in archaeology. And so we looked at her record, and it was very good. And even though she didn't have a lot of archaeological research, we thought, well, look, she's a professional musician. She's non-traditional. She knows how to work and focus and all this. So we accepted her into our master's program. And her thesis ended up being brilliant. It was featured on PBS NewsHour very briefly. And it was also published. What we did was I would make stone tools. Mm-hmm. And she would have her violin and actually pitch like the sound or the notes of the stone tool making. And she was able to pick out, you know, A's or E's or D's and all this sort of stuff. And so it was the first sort of auditory or musical assessment of stone tool making, which had implications for, you know, the evolution of hearing and all sorts of stuff. So yeah, and she went on to really get interested in cognition and how people hear things. And now is a PhD student at Kent State focusing on the brain. So yeah, it's pretty incredible. I mean, I could go on and on talking about our students and their successes. We've just been very fortunate to work with just a variety of tremendous human beings.
Definitely. I mean, it's fascinating. I feel like every time that I speak with you, like I'm like, I'm going to apply to their program.
Well, it's pretty fun, right? I mean, the idea of being able to recreate ancient technologies and reverse engineer them to figure out how they work. But we do traditional archaeology as well, right? We do digs and excavations and things like that, which is also useful, right? To get people doing outdoor field science. That opens up a lot of students to understanding, look, you know, science isn't just done in a laboratory. It's done outside. And some students love that. Some don't. They learn very quickly that archaeological excavation is fun for like 10 minutes. And then, you know, after days of bat-breaking work, it's less fun. But, you know, people figure out what they like.
Definitely, definitely. And I think that goes well, you know, talking about, you know, your research lab or, you know, outside of the lab and things like that. Obviously, a lot of your mentoring, as you've discussed, really focuses in on the research aspect. And, you know, for faculty and staff that are out there listening, you know, how do you support students in really that initiation of research and also conducting the research?
Yeah. So I think for me, you know, I've learned that every student is different and unique. And that may sound kind of trite, but it's an important thing to acknowledge explicitly. And so you can't treat students in any sort of cookie cutter manner. Like you have to tailor your mentoring to each student. Like you may have an overall style, but in my experience, you still have to alter and modify that style per person, right? I suppose the way we get them involved in research as well has to do with my view of what the university is, right? Which is, I see universities as factories of knowledge, right? And it is the job of the university to produce the output of knowledge. And you do that through research. And, you know, perhaps I might be considered the floor manager of, you know, a laboratory in this factory of knowledge. And the students are apprentices, right? In this factory, or they're on the assembly line and they're learning how the factory works. So, you know, we should never underestimate students' ability to create or produce or generate data or collect data, right? Get them involved doing the groundwork of what research is, which is collecting that data. And they learn so quickly, right? And, you know, you hear about how the young mind is often a fertile mind. And mm-hmm. you know, once they start thinking about how data is collected in these factories of knowledge, it is stunning how quickly they start having innovative ideas on their own. And then what we do is we will, you know, let's say they're a student is doing a research project. They've conducted an experiment that we've told them to do or collected data that we've asked them to collect. You know, we'll write the paper for them, right? Have them look at it and see, oh, the data I just collected has now been transformed into this output. Well, just that single process of them collecting the data and seeing how it turns out, and they see their name on it as a co-author, right? The next time around, they're actually the ones who are starting to write the paper. Now, we'll edit it heavily and all that sort of stuff, but I think we should never underestimate how quickly students can like just grasp the scientific process, and pretty soon they're doing it on their own. And that's how it works. I mean, and this is why I think an apprenticeship and this factory of knowledge approach is really important, because once they know how to do research, they carry that with them for the rest of their lives. And that's important even if they don't go into science. I mean, research is done in law, right? It's done in business. It's done in all aspects of life. And it also opens doors for them, we've found, because, you know, if you have undergraduates that are actively and substantively contributing to research and being co-authors, if not first authors on papers, right? When they apply for jobs or graduate schools or whatever, and their potential employer sees they have been published, it's hard to overestimate the impact that seeing that does for their future prospects. So it'd be for us, getting students involved in research in the factory of knowledge is vital.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it, really, for sure. And I think, you know, we all know that when learning a new process or something like that, there's obviously going to be some challenges, some setbacks that arise. So how do you work with students when those types of things come up?
Yeah, well, I think for us, it's the philosophy that there is no scientific study that is ever perfect, right? Anyway.
Yeah.
And this is I think something broader that, in my opinion, you know, all scientists need to adopt. Every paper I do or that our students do will be improved upon in the future, right? It's going to be more accurate, better technologies in the future. maybe different results. So, you know, we emphasize to our students, you know, that if this isn't going to be perfect, you just need to do your best. And describing to them the difference between perfection and doing your best can be different, right? It can be a challenge.
For sure.
But once they grasp that, like, their confidence, I find, goes through the roof. Because they realize that, like, you know, you can publish something that is going to be improved upon. I guess a better analogy would be that they're not trying to score a touchdown. Every scientific paper that my students publish or that we publish is just moving the ball a couple yards down the field. And so once they realize that they don't have to score a touchdown, they can just move the ball a couple yards down the field, it becomes very easy for them to publish and do research.
For sure. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I found, you know, my time in academic advising and working with students and things like that, that a lot of times the students themselves or the faculty or both sometimes forget that they are pursuing coursework while also doing research. So time management is a huge issue. So do you have any tips for students or for faculty and staff about balancing research and coursework?
Yeah. So I think, well, first, let me just say, I hesitate to give advice or to other faculty, right? Because there's all sorts of different fields out there and different styles of mentorship, all that sort of stuff. But for us, what we've always emphasized is that coursework has to come first, right? I mean, in fact, we have requirements. If you're going to be a student member of the Kent State Experimental Archaeology Lab, you have to have a certain GPA. Because, you know, we found some very bright students were coming to the lab and doing lots of lab work, but it was at the cost of their coursework. And if a student fails out, then what's the point of doing the lab work to begin with? And that was early on in the laboratory history, right? So we established GPA requirements and a few other requirements to make sure that students are going to class, because that's number one. So you have to do well in coursework to be a lab member. Now, once you do that, it's important for students to realize that their, you know, time is not an infinite resource, and you have to make choices. And so I think it's harder for students to make choices about their time today through no fault of their own, right? And it's because they have access to Netflix and social media, right? And it's so easy to be distracted by those things. YouTube, all sorts of things. When I was an undergraduate 20 years ago, oh my goodness.
back in the day, right?
Yeah. I mean, even having like my own student email account was interesting in the early 2000s. But, you know, we didn't have as many distractions. And that's just the way it was. And so it was much easier not to be distracted. So we always emphasize to our students that, look, you know, you have choices, and the choices you make now do influence your future. So if you choose to watch or binge watch a show on Netflix, that means that is time that is not dedicated to research. And if you choose to do that, that is fine. But you also need to understand that there are students elsewhere that are making a different choice, and they're not binge watching that show, and they are doing their research in their spare time. So you have to kind of think, well, if I'm going to be going up against a student and applying for PhD programs or jobs or something like that, I shouldn't be upset if they get it because they made a choice that I didn't. And so that's kind of the way we try to frame it to our students. You know, we never say, oh, you have to be in the lab or you have to do research, because work-life balance is also very important. But I think when you think about work-life balance, you also have to think about the work part and not just the balance part.
Yes.
Right? Sure. The only way you have that work-life balance is if you're doing both.
You have both things that are happening, right?
Yeah, both things are happening. It can't just be just balance. So yeah, that's kind of how we try to portray it to our students in the lab.
I guess one of the last, you know, things I wanted to ask, you know, for any students, you know, undergraduate, graduate that might be listening as well, do you have any specific, you know, resources or tools or anything like that that you often recommend to your students to enhance their research skills or time management or anything like that?
Yeah. So I think the thing I always emphasize to our students here is that you will never have as much time in your life as you do right now to read.
Yeah.
And by read, I mean books. And so it may seem obvious or simple, but like the library, right? I mean, and this goes again with making choices, right? Do I want to binge watch that show or do I actually do some reading? You know, I find more and more that reading just for pleasure and for knowledge isn't emphasized as much, which is a shame because, you know, reading is where you get ideas for tests and where you make connections and all sorts of things like that for science. So really, the library is the greatest resource. You know, spend time when you're most awake and most alert in the library. I mean, for me, when I read, I always read in the mornings. Mm-hmm. I find by the afternoon, I can't focus. I can't absorb knowledge as much. So I get up early in the morning and I do all my reading then, usually an hour or two when I can before my son wakes up for the day. But you may have another time, right? Maybe you like reading at night, maybe in the middle of the afternoon when you're eating lunch or something, but reading has to be done, right? Because you just don't have as much time for it later in life. Also, too, I would emphasize that when you read, when you're a student, you can read like scientific journal articles, but I would actually advise students to read books on science, popular books on science. And this is for two reasons. One, the scientific literature, and really the academic literature in general, right, is very dynamic. It changes. So you try to read an article, it may be different the next week, right? A new finding is made. No. But if you read books, you can build sort of this lattice of knowledge because the book has sort of summarized things for you. And the other great thing about books is that's often where assumptions are made. So if you're looking for a question to test, it's always better to find them in books because books are usually rife with assumptions that can be tested. And so that we emphasize that to our students as well when they're trying to come up with ideas for research. Just read some books and you'll identify assumptions that people made, scientists made, that you can now test in the laboratory.
That's great. And, you know, for me personally, I'm, you know, 20 years or so post-undergrad as well. And I'm trying to get better at that and reading at night instead of binge watching the shows. But yeah, you know,
for sure. And it's tough, right? I mean, because I think everyone is so tired, you know, from COVID and society and politics, and like all of us feel it. And so, you know, I will binge watch shows from time to time. I'm not saying that shouldn't occur.
Sure. Oh, right.
Right. But I think the thing is that we need to emphasize to our students that like we have choices and we are in control of what we do. And sometimes rather than choose, you know, this one option, you should choose this other option. Just because there are people out there who are making the opposite decision and you will be in competition with them. Now, if that doesn't bother you, let's say you're not that keen on getting into a PhD program, that's fine. That's cool. And, you know, we don't emphasize it any further. But for people who have ambitions to get places, it's important that they understand the choices that they make have consequences.
Definitely. Well, thank you for our conversation today. I really just wanted to close with asking, you know, are there any final thoughts, I guess, that you have for our audience today?
Just that there are a variety and diversity of mentoring styles. There are a variety and diversity of students. And so I think all of us need to be flexible in how we mentor and who we mentor. And you know, it's sometimes best if you can't mentor someone to be open to passing that student on to someone who will fit better. And that's happened to me before where, you know, for whatever reason, the student wasn't as interested in the research I do as they thought they were. So you get to know the student more and you're like, oh, you're actually interested in this other subject. Well, I know so-and-so at the university who can do that. So we also can't be greedy with our mentorship, right?
Yes.
Because again, as my chair, Marianne Raganti, says, we are here for the students. And if the best mentoring we can do is to pass them on to someone who can mentor them better, then that's what we should do.
wise words for sure. So thank you. Thank you once again, Dr. Aaron. And I do invite all of our listeners to visit cityprogram.org to learn more about our courses and webinars on research, ethics, compliance, and higher education. And I do look forward to bringing you more expert guests to discuss what's happening on campus. Thanks again.
Hey, thank you.